Yeah. I wanted to start by correcting my confusion at the end of last time when I showed you unrooted multifurcating tree shapes and claimed that, oh, look, it says six. There was a thing about 2, 3, 6, and so on. And I looked here and mistook this, which, of course, is not the count of the number of trees. It's the count of the number of tips. These are six-tip trees. There are 7 of them. I was wrong about saying that you could get the count of unrooted multifurcating trees by simply rerooting rerooting rooted multifurcating trees, and that you would, with like one more tip, and that you would get the same count. That's true for labeled tips, but it's not true for unlabeled. So for both the unrooted multifurcating trees and the unrooted bifurcating trees, you have to do it a different way, and I'm not going to go into how those were gotten. It's described in the book, and it's not all that important that we know the details of these algorithms. Mostly I wanted to give you that original Edwards and Cavalli-Sforza simplified algorithm and get that clear, and then show you how that could be turned into a count of unrooted trees for the bifurcating and multifurcating case with labeled tips. Without labeled tips, you got to do it differently. There is nothing wrong in the book that I know of on that. By the way, the book has lots of typos. If you get a hold of a copy of the book that is the first printing, the way to tell, there are some ways to tell based on what's on the back cover and so on, but the real way to tell is to go to the page after the title page. Let's see, I think it's the page after the title page, where there's a little row of numbers. You see this on any book. It'll be like 5, 4, 3, 2. If it says 5, 4, 3, 2, then you've got the second printing. If it says 5, 4, then you've got the fourth printing. And of those, the first printing was loaded with typos, my own fault. There were 250 typos corrected by the second printing, so that's much better. Another 50 or 60 by the third printing. And then we have 55 more typos waiting to be corrected. They are all up at a website, at the website of the book, at my lab websites. If you go, you just type Felsenstein lab, you'll quickly find my lab website. You'll find then my own web page. In there you'll find a link to the typos, and it's a big table of typos that I have. 55 of them are waiting to be corrected, and unfortunately Sinauer, in doing a new printing recently, they printed a fourth printing without asking me if there are any typos to correct. So third and fourth printings are basically the same, with a few little small non-typo correcting differences. And I hope that when they run out of the copies for the fourth printing, which maybe never, there'll be a fifth printing, in which case I finally will get those 55 typos out. None of them are terribly serious. There's also a list there of things that are wrong, arguments that are wrong in the book. I didn't want to do massive revisions. There never is going to be a second edition because it would be vastly different and much harder and much bigger. But there are some wrong arguments in the book, and I tell you about don't pay attention to this and don't pay attention to that, and try to give you some reasons why. Okay, anyway, so nothing wrong here. What I wanted to do was quickly get through labeled histories and then go on to talk about searching in tree space. And labeled histories were these rooted diagrams that look like they're trees and will have tree topologies as they do, but now we're distinguishing between the order in which the forks are. So you go along a time scale and you can go forward and say the first split is here and the second split here and here, but of these two, which order they're in, as in here and here, does not affect the tree topology. as we've been talking about tree topology. But if you make the distinction between these two, it does affect, those are different labeled histories. One way of thinking of them is to come back down the tree and ask which pair of lineages comes together, first, second, third, etc. There being a distinction between these, you can obviously see that there are more labeled histories than there are tree topologies. Labeled histories do become important for coalescence, which we get to much later in the course, almost at the end of the course.
Joe?
Yeah?
Are those divisions continuous or discrete? So is that like three, like one, two, three, or is that like a quarter of the way down and there's going to be variation for eight? Like, so if you went to the right-hand side, EC, and that split went like down just a little bit.
Would it be a different...
Not all the way to DF. Would it be a different labeled history?
No. Okay. No. The order is important.
Okay.
The exact timing isn't. Otherwise, we would know how many labeled histories there were. Infinity. Okay. Because each one of these could be an infinite number of... had an infinite number of locations. So it wouldn't be an interesting question. But we're gonna just take the order. And when you do that... It looks like, oh, that's going to be more complicated. We're going to have some much more sophisticated technology. But we don't, really. All we have to do is ask, of the N things up here, the number of species or the number of tips, how many pairs are there that could come together first? Well, the number of pairs of N things is very well known. It's n times n minus 1 over 2, which is, of course, n choose 2. So there are going to be n choose 2 possibilities for that very first pair that comes together. Having happened, there are now n minus 1 things, n minus 1 lineages. How many of those... Any pair could come together. How many of those are there? Well, it's n minus, it's the same quantity, but you've dropped n by 1. So it's n minus 1 times n minus 2 over 2. And so on. And when you do that, Anthony Edwards published this first. He cites E.A. Harding, a mathematician, probabilist in his department, at Cambridge University. Harding later published a whole paper on it, so I think this is actually probably Harding's argument. There are n choose 2 possibilities for the first pair to come together, n minus 1 choose 2 for the second pair, and you keep going until you get down to 2 lineages, and then there are 2 choose 2, which is 2 times 1 over 2, which is 1. There's only one way 2 lineages can come together. So what you're going to have, and I don't quite have it drawn on the, I don't quite have it on a slide, but let me put it up here. What you're going to have is a product with n times n minus 1 over 2 times n minus 1 times n minus 2 over 2 times n minus 3, sorry, n minus 2, you have to be careful here, times n minus 3 over here, all the way down to 2 times 1 over 2. And you might look at that and say, it looks a little ugly, but not really, because if you take every other term, if we go along and take the first, the third, the fifth, and so on, you get n times n minus 1 times n minus 2, whoops, times n minus 3, all the way down to 2. And then you're multiplying by the second, fourth, by the even numbered terms, which is n minus 2. I gotta get it wrong every time. N minus 1 times n minus 2 times n minus 3, dot, 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 all the way down to 1. And then how many factors of 2 are there on the bottom? There will be as many as there are the second number, so it's 2 to the n minus 1 times. And if you look at this, that first product here is just n factorial.
And the second product is just n minus 1 factorial, all over 2 to the n minus 1. So simple formula, product of n choose 2s, basically. And that gives you numbers. And the numbers are big. They're bigger than the number of tree topologies. And here they are. So for 2 tips, there's only 1 labeled history. For 3 tips, there are 3, because it's the same as the number of tree topologies. But immediately you get to 4 instead of 15, as we would have for bifurcating rooted tree topologies. You now have 18. That's because the tree shape that has a fork and then 2 forks, there are 3 of those, and each one has 2 possible orders that those 2 forks could be in. But then you jump up to 180 and so on. When you get up to 10, instead of 34,459,000 and so on, you have 2.5 times 10 to the 9. Okay, so you went up from 34 million to 2.5 billion. So much bigger. And you can see these get big very fast. So you get up even to 20, and you're up to 10 to the 29. Let's see. We had for 20, it was something like 8.2 times 10 to the 21. Here it's 10 to the 29, so it's a factor of 10 to the 8th, 100 million times more. So there's lots of them. The point is that there's very big numbers. And those that comes in when you consider strategies for computation with coalescence, where you want to avoid saying, let's consider all the possible labeled histories one at a time, because there are too many of them. So, okay. So I think that's all for the counting of tree topologies, tree shapes, labeled histories. And I'm going to move on to how we now go out into the space, very large spaces of trees, and find good trees when we're have some data and we have a criterion such as parsimony. So before we go there, any questions that should be handled before we get to that? Okay, I will now try to get this to go. Yeah, there we go. Okay, so we're gonna search for trees. And to remind you, the correct way of thinking about computing or about reconstructing trees is to think about a space of all possible trees and have a criterion and ask, how do we search in this space for criterion? It is not to just think of the algorithm and say, which 2 lineages should we put together first and which 2 next, because then you don't look at the bigger picture. And this turns out to be a much much clearer way to deal with these things. Okay, so I just want to remind you about a simple property of wandering around in a space looking for trees that have good numbers. We have fast algorithms, and we talked about those, the Fitch and Sankoff algorithms, for taking any tree that anyone gives us and computing a number. And the amount of effort involved is proportional to the number of species. If you double the number of species, roughly double the effort. It's also roughly proportional to the number of characters, but not quite, because sometimes characters, you can reuse the computations from one character for another character, and so it's not quite as bad as proportional to the number of a number of sites, let's say, or the number of characters in the data table. The point is, it's pretty fast. Going and looking at all trees gets to be incredibly slow. So the thing I want to talk about today is heuristic search, which is a fancy way of saying messing about in tree space and just trying to find something reasonably good. And the general strategy that everybody uses is look at some neighboring trees, evaluate them, and if you find one or more that are better than your current tree, move to those. Or
you know, to be a little more sophisticated, you might keep a list of all the ones tied for best and go consider one of them or consider them in turn. There's all kinds of variations. And the important thing to know is that there's no deep mathematics here. It is just intuitive messing about strategies for what's in computer science is called greedy search. Greedy search because you see something better, oh boy, let's go there, let's not consider whether it's the best thing in the world, let's just go get the next thing that turns out that's good. So generally speaking, you're starting somewhere in a tree space. Now, I have to say, as you'll see in a moment, tree spaces actually don't look like this. This is a two-dimensional space with a third dimension, which is height. Here we're imagining searching for the highest points in the space. On a tree space, we're searching for the smallest number of changes, so it's kind of upside down from this. But also, the connectivity of the trees doesn't actually look like this. It's really very far from a two-dimensional space. But let me just use this to make a simple point. We look at neighboring trees. We find one that is best, and it's either of the neighbors which one is best, or it's just start looking at the neighbors, and as soon as you find one that's better, go to that. That's a quicker and dirtier greedy search. And if we just keep doing that, we're hill climbing. So you can imagine this thing going up the hill until it reaches a point up here where any step in any direction, the neighbors that it considers, is downhill. Looks at all the neighbors, none of them is better. Now you're at a local maximum. The analogy I always like to use is at the scale that humans are, if you try to go uphill from this building, you will go up through campus, you'll emerge from the 17th Avenue exit, you'll go uphill shallowly up 17th Avenue to get to about 55th, and then you're at the local maximum. But it's not the top of Mount Everest. It's the peak we can find locally. And in this drawing, we ended up there, but the global maximum might, for example, be here. Okay, so there's no guarantee that you get to the most parsimonious tree or find the set of most parsimonious trees or with any other criterion. We'll see distance matrix criterions and likelihood, for example, that you'll do well in them. It's a heuristic, greedy, approximate, rough search, and things like strategies of what trees are your neighbors and how do we get to, you know, how do we find a bunch of neighboring trees, again are not done by deep mathematical theory, but they're just messing about. People thought of all sorts of ways of messing about with a tree and coming up with neighbors. And there's all sorts of strategies about how many of them you keep. Do you keep all the best ones or just one of the best ones, for example? And there's nothing deep mathematically in that. But let's imagine we're going to do this kind of greedy search. One of the things also that you'll see that we'll want to do is multiple starts. Try starting in different parts of the space and go uphill from there and see if you can find a higher peak. Well, the first thing I want to do is just show you a simple way of rearranging a tree so as to get a related tree. And this one is actually important because I think it somehow is fundamental to the structure of tree space in a way that the other ways of rearranging I show you won't be. Let's imagine an unrooted tree, and we're searching in a space of unrooted trees. And there's an interior branch here, and it connects at each end to a node, and there are two other, it's an unrooted bifurcating tree. Each of those connects to some other stuff. So what we're going to have in this S here is not a single tip, but a whole subtree. It's a whole... You can think it's in a sense rooted here, so you could treat it as a rooted bifurcating tree extending out from there. And similarly at T and at U and at V. So it might be a very big tree, And those are just subtrees, and we're just going to consider them. And then one of the things you can say is, well, suppose we do a local rearrangement of the tree. Well, what does that mean? In this case, it's going to mean what's called the nearest neighbor interchange, which would be swapping some of these branches. Or the more general way of considering it is that you just dissolve those connections. So you dissolve the branch that you're thinking about and the ones immediately connecting to it. And then you're left with the four subtrees just sort of floating out there in space. And you think, well, what are all the ways I could connect those four things into an unrooted tree? And you will see, if you went back to the counts we did, you'll see that the number of unrooted tree topologies when you have four tips is three. One of them is this one that we came from, and we're not interested in it particularly. We have the count for that one. The other two are here. And it's just a matter of which two are, you know, you could think of it as what is next to, what is at the same end as S? And the answer is it could be U, or it could be T, or it could be V. This one, of course, this branch is going through, that one's going underneath, and then there's the branch connecting them. So there's three possibilities, and that means that dissolving this branch, there are two immediate nearest neighbor interchange rearrangements. They are equivalent to switching, say, S with T. If I switched S with T, I would get T next to U. Let's see where that is. I'd get this one down here. If I switched S with V, I would get... Let's see, if I switch S with V, what would I get? Yes, I would get this one here. Okay. So you can think of them as switching neighbors, or you can think of them as dissolving a region of the tree and connecting it up. Okay, those are nearest neighbor interchanges. Now, when you have the full set of tips and the full tree, let's take a small case. Let's take the case of only five tips. You can look at these and how they relate neighboring trees. And here's where we get this diagram. For five tips, there are 15 unrooted five-species trees. And so what I did here is I wrote down all 15 of those trees. I drew them, being careful to get them all. And I drew lines between them, and the result was a complete mess. And then I gave it to Ben Schoenberg, who's my stepson, and who had a little training in combinatorial geometry. And I said, could you arrange this into a nicer looking diagram? And he did, and he came back with this. So I'm calling it the Schoenberg graph. Here is the tree with A next to B, D next to E, C coming off in the middle. All of the trees have the same tree shape. When we take these and start doing nearest neighbor rearrangements, remember that each time we use an interior branch and do that, there are two alternatives. If you look here, you will find that, draw it over here, A, B, C, D, E. There are two interior branches to that tree. Okay, all the other branches are exterior, they connect to a tip. And by the way, if you dissolve those, you go nowhere, because it turns out it's an exterior branch. When you reform it, it's got to have the same C on there, and you actually just get back to the same tree. Nothing happens. But you can do nearest neighbor interchange in two different ways. One is by dissolving this branch, and then before the subtrees will be this one, that one, and both of those. Okay, and then you reform them. And when you do, if I can see this properly, AB is still going to be there as a pair of nearest neighbors. And there is going to be, here is a line that is one of the things that can come out of that. So what that does is, let's see. No, I'm sorry.
We are reforming. We are going to we're going to leave DE. That's it. We have to still have DE there as a group. So I'm backwards there. Let's see. If I go down here or along this branch, ducking under that one, over to that tree, both of those have got DE on them. Those are the two nearest neighbor arrangements of where we dissolve the left-hand interior branch. Here are the two nearest neighbors where you dissolve the right-hand interior branch. When you look at them, you find that there's a loop of this goes to here, this goes to there. Those are sort of two sides of a triangle. The third side is what happens when you go from here to here. Those are the three trees you can form that you can have when you dissolve that branch. One of them was the one you came from. So there's a sort of facet here, which is a triangle, although the side isn't drawn straight here. And likewise over here, one, two, three, those three are another facet. So this whole thing has got these triangles in it. Each tree is connected to four others. The whole thing is isotropic, which means it doesn't matter where you are in this graph, the topology is the same of things around you. Here we see these triangles for rearrangements. For example, this tree, this triangle keeps BD on it, although in one of those trees I've drawn BD over to the right. That is the result of dissolving the, let's see if I get it correctly, the right interior branch of that tree. Anyway, this has this tremendous symmetry. I mean, it really... The other thing to look at is, if you take it... So this is, in a sense, tree space. That's what tree space looks like with five tips. Tree space with six tips has two different tree shapes. It's not worth drawing because it would drive you crazy. You just imagine what would happen with larger numbers of tips. In that space, there it's not true that the space looks the same no matter which one you're at. There are two different tree shapes, and it's kind of like a soccer ball where it looks perfectly symmetrical, but there are these there's two kinds of corners on the soccer ball. There's two kinds of corners in the 105 tree space. But this example will at least give you a feel for what these spaces look like. And the one thing you can say is also that they're very high dimensional. If you take it and you squash it down onto a plane, which is what I've done here, all kinds of lines cross that aren't really where those crossing doesn't really matter. The term for that in graph theory is that it's not a planar graph. It's a sort of very high dimensional looking graph. But that's kind of what tree space looks like. And I will argue later in the course that when we start changing branch lengths and thinking about continuous variation of trees, this thing becomes important. And you end up getting a bunch of high-dimensional, real-valued chunks glued together in a way that actually corresponds to this. So in some sense, this is fundamental. Well, suppose we're going to do wandering around in tree space, and we're going to do it by nearest neighbor interchange. So we're going to start with a tree, start making these local rearrangements, see if any of them improves the tree. If it does improve, we might, discard our current tree, take the new tree. Well, what we can do is take the data set that we had, the same one we used last week, and simply evaluate the number of steps at all those trees. And there it is. And you can glance at it and say, ha-ha, here is the most parsimonious tree. There is only exactly one of them in this case. There might be more in general. There's a bunch of them. There's five of them that have nine. There's two of them that has 10, and there's six of them, whatever it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of them that are 11 steps. So every tree has 8, 9, 10, or 11 steps as the minimum number of steps you could have on that particular tree. So what will happen if you start doing nearest neighbor interchanges? And we start with, say, this one. Okay. Well, we can look around it. We find a 10, a 9, an 11, and an 11. And that, at this point, leaves you with some ambiguity as to what to do, because I never really said what your rule was. If it's the issue that the first time you find one that's better, you move to it, in this case, you might have moved to this 10. Then, looking around from that, you find another 10, a 9, an 8, and the one we came from. Depending upon your strategy, if as soon as you find a neighbor that's better, you go, you might say, well, we find, let's see if I get this right, another 10, 9, and then we go to the 9. Or we could wait till we looked at all of them, in which case we go to 8, and we would have found the most parsimonious tree. So in this case, and in general, it's better to wait until you've looked at all the neighbors and pick the best of them. It's obviously a more rigorous criterion. But if we went up here to 9 and then we looked around, what would we see? Another neighbor that's 9, a neighbor that's 11, the one we came from that was 10, and a neighbor that's 9. Now, there's again an ambiguity there. What do you do if there's a tie? It's possible to find yourself on what people have called plateaus in tree space. So there are groups of trees that are connected to each other. There are neighbors under whatever criterion you're using. Do you want to wander randomly there? I don't think so, because you'd never finish. If it were an isolated plateau and with nothing better connected to it. Or do you want to simply make a big list and collect all of them, which could get very big and tedious. If you simply looked at the neighbors, saw whether any were better, and if none were better, said, okay, we're at a local peak, then you would stop here. Otherwise, you might collect this 9, and then from that, collect this 9. Those, by the way, don't have as their neighbors the 8. Oh, well, if you kept collecting, you'd collect this 9 and this 9, and then trying to do local rearrangements on all of those, which is a more tedious way, you would find 8. You'd spread out over the tree plateau, and one of them would connect to something better. In this case, it's the most parsimonious tree. But when you arrive at the most parsimonious tree and none of the neighbors are any better, you know you're at a local optimum in tree space. You don't know that you're at a global optimum. Okay. So there's all kinds of variations of strategies based on something like nearest neighbor interchange, but there are also other kinds of interchange that could look at a larger variety of trees and give you a sort of bigger search. So one of them is called subtree pruning and regrafting. It's quite commonly used, or SPR, subtree pruning and regrafting. Again, to emphasize, nothing mathematically sophisticated about this. You yourself could think of more elaborate kinds of rearrangement, and people have done so. But this is widely used. And basically what it says is, take your tree, rip off a subtree. In this case, we could rip off what is connected by this branch. We'll consider this one to be the rip-E that is being ripped off, although you can see there it's kind of symmetrical. You could think of it the other way, and that turns out to actually give you something different. So we'll rip off that subtree. Now what we've got here's the result, is this tree, we ripped off the subtree, we healed up this branch. That's this over here. Here is the subtree with its root still there. And then, the obvious, put it back in all possible places. So we look at this left tree and we say, well, it could go back on this branch or this branch or this branch or this branch or this or this or that. There's the branch. Where is the branch it came off of? It is this one.
So I'm not counting putting it back on that branch, because that would just get you back to where you were. And when you do, we could evaluate. We could put it one at a time in all these places. You have to have the computer program keep track of. You make a new tree, and then after evaluating, you take the thing back off and then put it somewhere else and make a new tree. Evaluate those all. Pick the best of them. Although there might be more than one. Put it there. Here's a new tree. Okay, so this tree is a neighbor of that tree under subtree pruning and regrafting. Now, what do you think? With nearest neighbor interchange, every interior branch has two neighbors there under nearest neighbor interchange. Under subtree pruning and regrafting, you can see, well, I won't ask you even, you can see that there are more neighbors. Because every other interior branch, other than the one that was formed when you ripped it off, is a neighbor. So it's a bigger set of neighbors. So it will do a better search. And you might say, well, maybe it's a different search. And the answer is actually no, in a sense, because among the neighbors, particularly if you put them back near in branches nearby, you can form all of the both of the nearest neighbor interchanges. So nearest neighbor interchanges are part of this set of things that you do with subtree pruning and regrafting. So it is a more thorough search. It connects to more neighbors, so you get to wander further and probably find a better peak if you do subtree pruning and regrafting. And then there's one more that people use a lot called TBR, tree bisection and reconnection. The reason to know these names is really just that you will see them in the literature. You'll see them in the documentation of computer programs. They say, we do SPRs and blah, 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 and you'll know then what it is. So you start with an unrooted tree. Now, instead of ripping a subtree off, we dissolve a line. So we take one of the interior branches and we dissolve it, forming two subtrees. There they are. Now at that point it looks kind of similar, but if you look at this one over here, it doesn't have a root anymore. Before we were ripping off here, and then this thing had a root sticking out, and wherever you put it back, it was going to be by putting that root somewhere in the tree. Here you have two unrooted trees. How are you going to connect them? Well, you're going to connect them by connecting a branch of one to a branch of another. And which branches? The answer is any pair. So in this subtree here, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 branches. In this one over here, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 branches. Connect any one of the 7 with any one of the 9. There are then 63 possible trees you could form. One of them, the ones you would get by connecting this branch to all the possibilities over here, those are the SPR trees. So again, nearest neighbor is a subset of what you do with SPR, which is in turn a subset of what you do with TBR. So in this case, there's from the breaking of that branch, there are 63 neighbors. And from the breaking of each other branch here, there's about the same number of neighbors. And it isn't exactly the same for the different branches. There's lots more neighbors under this. So again, if you do TBR, you're doing a more thorough search. But of course, it'll be slower. Yeah?
Both of these are applicable to also rooted trees, right?
They are, let's see, let me think. You could take a rooted tree, you can do nearest neighbor interchange on it straightforwardly. You get two other, each time you dissolve a branch and reconnect it, you come up with a rooted tree because you still have the root hanging on somewhere, so that'll root the whole thing. So nearest neighbor interchanges basically go the same. With rooted trees. SPR also, you're ripping off a rooted tree from, and the piece, you'd have to say that the piece you left behind is the one that has the overall root of the tree, and then you're sticking it on at all possible places. TBR, I think, also works fine on rooted trees. You just have to have that after you've dissolved a branch, one of them has a root on it, and whatever you connect up, you just let that be the root of the new tree. They all are applicable to both rooted and unrooted trees, and they are grossly different between those. Okay, so these are just ways people have come up with of messing about in tree space. And they allow you to wander further. There are strategic differences. Do you keep a lot of ties? Do you rearrange on all those ties, or do you just keep one of them and rearrange on that? Obviously, that's less thorough and won't get you as good a tree. And in all of these cases, when you end up at a place where none of the neighbors are any better, and none are even tied, you may have a best tree, you may have a set of best trees, but you cannot be sure that that's the most parsimonious tree, or the set of most parsimonious trees. Oh, here, I should have said, here's the result of connecting this branch with that one, which is just one of the possibilities. And so this rearranges into that. They may look very different, but if you look at the detailed structure, you'll see that they're similar in a lot of places. Okay, so where do we go from here? Ah, yeah. Now, you will remember that when we talked about going down through a tree and counting steps, we were having these, at each site, we were having a little array. In the case of DNA, it would be of four numbers. And we keep those. And I pointed out something I'm going to basically re-point out here, that if you save those little arrays, then when you rearrange a tree, you can economize on the computation because parts of the tree that you didn't rearrange, you don't have to go back through and count up all the steps there. You can just use the array at the bottom end of that, at the near end of those subtrees. Here is a way you can use that to economize a little further. You basically go through the tree making those little arrays. If you say to yourself, I would like to rearrange, do a nearest neighbor interchange here. Let me see. If I'm doing, I think it's a TBR, and I'm dissolving this branch, and I'm going to connect that branch, and now I want to evaluate the resulting tree. You'll see that parts of the tree are, I think this slide just needs a little work, but parts of the tree, like B through G, is a subtree that you didn't do anything to. It's whole there. So you can just, in figuring out the steps on the new tree, you can take the arrays at each site. You can take the array, if you kept them, you can take them and work from those and not ever have to go back up into that subtree. And likewise, there are subtrees here and here and here and here, all of which aren't disturbed by dissolving the one branch and then putting in the other branch. But some of the stuff in this region does have to be recalculated. I think the labeling I've got up here is wrong. Let's see, V through Z is still there. S through U is still there. And for this branch to be put in, H through R is still there. And one thing you can do, one thing that people do is to go through the subtree, to go through the tree making these little arrays and do it sort of by trying it with roots in all possible places. I won't go into this. And when you do that, then when you connect up something like this, you always have something nearby. That's the summary of coming through that undisturbed part of the tree. If this isn't clear, forget it. It isn't really right. There are some nice tricks, and the nice tricks have to do with leaving behind these arrays and pre-computing them for all possible routings, then leaving them there, and then when you rearrange something, you generally don't have to look at too many other parts of the tree in order to get the new score. So you can get the new score very quickly. This was used, tricks like this were in use by people writing a number of programs in the 1980s and on into the 90s. In 1993, it was published by Pablo Golubov. It's an interesting fact that there were all kinds of these little bookkeeping tricks and rearranging methods early in the history, which I'll explain to you basically starts in the 1970s of 60s a little bit and on into the 70s. People used all these bookkeeping tricks, but when they came to write up their methods, they didn't really think it was worth mentioning. And so there was all this sort of lore, useful trick lore that was floating around. And it wasn't really until the 90s that people realized it actually might be worthwhile publishing a paper saying what some of this trickery was. So you've got quite a few papers out there that invent new methods that actually were already in use. And often the authors didn't realize that. Okay. One of the things we do also is to what's called sequential addition. In addition to taking a tree, and a full-size tree, and rearranging it, there's the issue of, well, what could we do by starting out with one or a few species and gradually adding species in all possible places? And there's a general approach called sequential addition. It's not very surprising. It says you take the species in some order. You make an unrooted tree. Let's say we're doing unrooted trees, or the first three of them. And then you consider all the places you could add the fourth species in. So what we have is an unrooted tree here, and then I put little stubs here indicating where you could add species D. And as you add species D, there are three branches, so you get three possible trees, which are, in fact, all three possible four-species trees. Each of those has five places that you could add the next one. Now, you'll remember that this from the counting trees argument. When you evaluate them, here are the scores you get, by the way, on our data set, which is 8 and 7 and 9. In sequential addition strategies of messing about, of heuristic tree search, you pick the best of those, and then you add the next species in all places to that. So here we take the 7, and we add species E in all five possible places. And there they are, and they get 9, 9, 9, 9, and 11. Now you'll notice something. It's the same data set, the same species. The optimum tree is actually has a size of 8. It's descended from this one. It's one of the things you get by adding E here. But if you look at these trees before you add E, the best of them seems to be that one. And if you follow a sequential addition strategy, you actually won't find the most parsimonious tree this way in this data set. So, again, that's widely used. For example, in some of my programs, in the file-up package, a general strategy we use is we do sequential addition, saving only one tree, keeping one best tree. After each layer of addition, after you've added D and after you've added E and after F, we go through a round of nearest neighbor interchanges. When we get to the best, when we've got the best single full tree from that, we then do a round of subtree pruning and regrafting. So, I mean, it's a typical set of decisions that somebody might make writing such a program. There's no argument I have that that's the best way to do it. Other people do more elaborate rearrangements. They find better trees. Okay, so sequential addition, but sequential addition is important, used a lot. There's another thing called star decomposition. There's a couple more items in this heuristic search stuff, but we're at the end of our time, so I'll pick those up Wednesday. I should say also Wednesday I'll be giving you the assignment for the first homework, it's basically going to be to take, find a data set, analyze it by parsimony with a program that you go out and get, whatever it is, and I will give you some indication what to report. So I'll give you that assignment on Wednesday, but you can start in on it anytime you want.